This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today, we are in Gap.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. I'm with Daniel Free.
Hi, Lionel.
And we're without our lighthouse today. We're without the talisman, Richard Moore. He's out on the Col de Monts. Probably on your third beer by now, I would have thought.
But where are we, Lionel?
We're where we always are in Gap. We're outside this another ugly building on a trading estate where they stick us members of the press. We're surrounded by the Alps, so it's always quite nice when you're in the centre of Gap and you see all the mountains all around you, and the Alps are just on the horizon. We've got a rest day before that, and then the Alps, and then Paris, and then home. I don't want to skip to the end of the tour. There's still plenty to talk about between now and then. This evening, in Richard's absence, he's out on a not-so-secret kilometre zero assignment. We are joined by Velo News Andy Hood.
Good evening.
And you're here because you are you're our man in Spain, really. You know, you've got your finger on the pulse of everything Spanish. We had a Spanish stage winner today. Ruben Plaza won into Gap, tacked on the climb, held off a flying Peter Sagan on the descent. Tell us a little bit about Ruben Plaza. We know very little about him.
Yeah, Ruben Plaza is one of these journeyman Spanish pros, kind of an old school guy. Started his career back in the early 2000s, bounced around to get his name kind of caught up in the Operación Puerto 2006. Restarted his career. He raced one season in Portugal, where a lot of those guys ended up. Kind of got a second chance at his career with Movistar, raced there quite a few years, and then joined Lampre this year. Veteran, experienced guy, knows how to race his bike, how to handle his bike. We saw him today descend like an absolute madman to fend off Sagan, a dramatic victory.
Sounds like a fairy story, eh? The sort of one of those journeyman Spaniards who may or may not have been caught up in things that he perhaps shouldn't have been. But
what a romantic tale it is.
Well, it's interesting, though. You didn't get asked many questions about, you know, doping or power outputs or anything in the press conference, did he?
No, you know, that's a very good point, actually. It seems that Froome brought it up in his press conference today. Everyone always slings those arrows at him. I was at the Giro this year. Not one person asked Contador anything about his clenbuterol case, about his numbers, about, you know, him trying to do the double in the modern peloton. There was not one question the entire Giro about and those, along those themes.
Just, I know we don't want to dwell on the power output issue too much at all, if at all. However, at the finish this afternoon, I spoke to Fred Grapp, the physiologist at FDJ. There are moves afoot initiated by Fred Grapp to start some kind of voluntary organisation. Now, don't all switch off now, because I know we've had it up to the eyeballs with voluntary organisations assuring the credibility of cycling. But Fred Grapp wants to start with fellow physiologists. There's a group of them that often exchange ideas. They have a big meeting every year before the Tour de France. They're going to set up a voluntary organisation where they actually are taking raw data off riders, and they're going to have a working group, and they're going to assess things. And they are going to draw conclusions. I don't really know how they're going to police it, what they're going to do if someone falls foul of the thresholds that they establish. But he was fed up of the report last night on France Television about Chris Froome. And another thing that Fred Grapp is going to do, he's going to organise a course for us journalists around about Christmas time in Paris, so that we can go and we can get a lesson on power outputs and how to interpret them, and, you know, how to report this issue.
Very thoughtful of him to arrange it for Christmas time in Paris. That'll be certainly a trip we'll all be on, I'm sure. So today's stage then, stage number 16, getting close to the end now. It was from Bourges le Péage near Valence, over to Gap, the gateway to the Alps, so to speak. Well, not so to speak, it literally is the gateway to the Alps. Now, we drove the course today, Daniel, didn't we? Because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, we wanted to drop Richard off at the top of the Col de Monts for his assignment. And secondly, because the off-course itinerary, which a lot of the race vehicles and particularly the team buses use to get from start to finish because they can't drive on the course, was 370 kilometres long. And that caused quite a few logistical problems today. I've been making a kilometre zero episode about the team buses, and a lot of them didn't make it to the finish today because they had 370 kilometres to drive in the time that the riders had a 201 kilometres to ride. There was a jackknife lorry on the auto route, so some of the buses didn't get here. Fortunately, Team Sky, for example, who were staying in Sisteron, they brought their bus and took, I think, a camper to the start, up various other teams. It was a real logistical nightmare of a day for some of the teams. The most notable thing about our day out on the road, I think, was passing Oleg Tinkoff, wasn't it? The Tinkoff Saxo team owner. He was in full camouflage fluorescent kit riding his bike very fast.
I thought he looked quite impressive, actually. The other very significant thing that we saw, or we were looking out for, was Bolocchi Corner, of course, on the Col de Mons, the infamous spot where José Bolocchi came off in 2003. Pretty much, as you pointed out, the timeline or ruined his career, that crash. And that descent, we knew it was going to be, well, we knew it would cause problems, and so it proved, didn't it, in the stage. Very narrow, gnarly descent, rugged surface, some nasty tight bends, blind bends, and there was a very spectacular crash, wasn't that, involving Geraint Thomas and Warren Barguil. I don't know who of you spoke to Van Garderen at the finish line, but I'm led to believe he said that it was Barguil's fault. I think we'll hear from Warren Barguil in just a second. He said it was Van Garderen's fault. And Thomas, he was fairly ambivalent, as he usually is about most things.
Yeah, I mean, he, as we'll hear, he did say, you know, he was mystified as to why riders don't just, on a descent that's as notorious as that, why they don't just go down in single file. What's the difference between being third or fifth? But yeah, spectacular crash. Barguil came up on the right-hand side of Thomas and basically barged him. Thomas then went flying over a white picnic chair, hit his head on a telegraph pole and plummeted over the edge out of sight. Fortunately, something broke his fall and a French spectator helped him back out. And he made a comment that he lost his white, distinctive white sunglasses, and he's annoyed about that because they don't make them anymore. I think they must be Oakley's.
Well, shall we hear from him?
Well, we shall hear from him, yeah. So this is Geraint Thomas at the finish talking about his crash.
Bad in the fact that I lost, you know, time, but which is annoying, you know, you make the effort to get over the climb and then I don't understand some guys, you know. Just go down the hill in one line, you know, what's the I feel alright. I headbutted the wooden pole thing and luckily there was a barrier thing and it stopped me falling, so it's all tangled up in the bushes and the wire thing and some guy pulled me up and it was alright. There's some French people like us. Oh, it was Wout. They were telling him to stay with Froome for the descent, you know, make sure he's okay. And then Wout, I don't know. I just saw him then with a K to go and, you know, he helped me. So thank him for that. It wasn't too bad. It was just, you know, you're getting a new bike and you're just annoyed that you're, just got wiped out.
The doctor, you know, asked me a few questions, my name and stuff. Tell him I'm Chris Froome.
So that was Geraint Thomas, his version of events. What about Warren Barguil of Giant Alpecin, who... Well, he made final contact with Thomas, but what did he make of the crash?
I saw the corner and I was starting to brake and you have a TJ just behind me, pushed me on the shoulder and I lose my finger on the brake. And it's 2 seconds when you can't brake and it was too late. And really sorry for Geraint, because it was not on purpose. And, really, really sorry.
So that was Warren Barguil. Andy, did you speak to TJ Van Garderen afterwards?
Sure, every person has their own version of events in this situation. Van Garderen said that Barguil was trying to come over him, going into that corner, fighting for position. So they touched shoulders. Barguil was saying that he couldn't brake for a few seconds. That's what took him off his line. Van Garderen shot through, and he was definitely laying the blame on Barguil in that situation.
Well, it was a very difficult descent. It was difficult enough to drive, even in our smooth-handling Jaguar. I was driving down the descent, and a lot of the corners... What's deceptive about it is that some of them are tight and some of them are not so tight. So the riders, when they're on the limit, they get lulled into thinking that one corner might be like the last and that you might be able to take a similar sort of line. It's sometimes quite difficult to see when you're going into the corner how... the exit of the corner is, and of course, as Daniel says, the road surface is pretty rutted. I spoke to Jakob Fuglsang of the Astana team afterwards. He was actually with Tony Galopin, who went straight on one of those hairpin corners, and it gave him the heebie-jeebies, I think, because he then lost quite a lot of time. I think he was already off the back over the climb anyway, but he had a pretty wretched time on the descent, and he's plummeted out of the top 10 to 11th. So this is Jakob Fuglsang talking about the Col de Mons. Jakob, we've seen the descent in the Col de Mons several times in the Tour de France. There always seems to be incidents. What do you make of using that road? Because it's a very challenging descent for the riders, isn't it?
Yes, it is. course, everybody knows that it's a place where you can make up time if you take risk. And it seems like every year somebody takes the risk, but that's in the end of the day, that's part of the racing. I was in a group with Tony Galopin, who went straight. I don't know if anybody else crashed, but I hope that Tony didn't hurt himself and hope that nobody got hurt.
What happened to Tony? We didn't see it on the TV.
He went straight in the corner. He completely missed the corner. I think he was maybe not there anymore, and were pushing it a little bit too hard, and was going too fast, trying to catch up, and he looked like he completely, really oversaw the corner.
The corners are very tight, but some of them are very fast also, and the road surface is, you know, sometimes not the best. Is it one of the most challenging descents in the tour route?
That I don't think, and the road surface in the end now is better than it was a few years ago, so it's not terrible.
And when one person takes a risk, other riders have to follow.
If they don't want to lose time, that's how the game is.
Fairly pragmatic answers from the Dane there. I suppose you could summarise that as saying the tour is the tour. You have to go down as well as go up, don't you? But we know that descent always creates stories. The GC battle wasn't necessarily as exciting as we might have hoped. Everyone bar Geraint Thomas and Tony Galopin got down safely. Vincenzo Nibali attacked. Alberto Contador attacked first, but Vincenzo Nibali made it stick over the top, and he gained, approaching half a minute. But really, I mean, what is it? It's just a sort of token effort at this stage, isn't it?
Yeah, it was the equivalent of a sort of, I know that people hate the footballing analogies, but it was kind of a Cruyff turn in the corner, a shimmy, and some kind of truffle shuffle, and a 45-yard howitzer into the top corner when you 4-0 down.
very good analogy. How do you see the GC battle shaping up at the moment, Andy? We've got the rest day tomorrow, and then four difficult and varied stages in the Alps, a different challenge every day.
Yeah, I think the big story is really going to be on the podium. I mean, Froome looks really untouchable. I think Movistar is going to play their 1-2 punch. You know, Valverde fourth, closing in on Van Garderen. But are they racing for that third place podium, or are they really trying to race to set up Nairo, you know, for this, you know, send Valverde up the road, force Froome to chase, send Nairo up the road, and then that might, you know, blow out some matches for Valverde. He might lose that podium spot trying to help Nairo win. So for the Americans, of course, that's a huge issue for TJ, who's riding in third into the Alps, best American ride, since those bad old days. It's been a while since we had American bouncing near the podium. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch, how that third, fourth, fifth place plays out, if Van Garderen can keep that third place podium spot. I think Praloop is not good for TJ. Alpe d'Huez is better for him. But, you know, let's just hope Nairo can deliver a bomb and make the miracle, at least an attack, and put Froome in some trouble.
What's the dynamic like in the Movistar team, particularly between Quintana and Valverde? They have this twin strategy, but it never seems terribly clear, from the outside at least, what their aim is. As you say, are they looking to catapult Quintana into first place, as long a shot as that currently looks, or is Valverde's personal ambitions, which always seem to be to the forefront of his thinking, you know, is he thinking, well, I can get on the podium, finish third, perhaps even second?
Yeah, it's interesting because Valverde actually seems to be enjoying his role as a second fiddle to Nairo. Valverde's had some great collapses in the history of his career where he's basically just choked. And by having Nairo kind of have to carry that way, the team is actually helping him, kind of liberating him in a lot of ways. And he's been able to flow through this tour. He hasn't really done anything, really. He's been following wheels, doing a few jabs here and there. But I think he's only saving his matches for the Alps. That's what the whole team's thinking. They're really still frustrated about losing that time in the echelons. Because when you look at the time that Nairo has actually lost to Froome, it's only a little more than a minute in real time.
Yeah, and if that was all that he had lost, you would almost say that the tour was going exactly to plan for them, because Quintana was always going to put set a lot of importance on the last week, wasn't he? He was always going to look at these big stages with multiple alpine passes to gain time on Froome.
Yeah, I mean, they're both dreaming of winning on the Alpe d'Huez. Froome wants to win that stage in the yellow jersey. Nairo wants to deliver the miracle win for South America, the first yellow jersey for a South American rider. It has a potential to be a classic race, but I really think that they need to take back some time before going to Alpe d'Huez to have a realistic chance of trying to dethrone Froome with 3 minutes.
And what about Alberto Contador? Because as Daniel pointed out a few days ago, Tinkoff Saxo seemed to have thrown their weight a little bit more behind Peter Sagan, really. They were working for him in the lead-outs a few days ago. Contador doesn't seem to have the zip in his legs, certainly, that we saw in the Giro.
Yeah, you know, he has that give when his head kind of starts wobbling. You know, we saw that in the Pyrenees, really. You could see right away that, that Contador just didn't have the legs, didn't have the spark in his legs to really go with those accelerations.
He looks like a wonderful thoroughbred dog that's about to be put down, doesn't he? He's kind of, unfortunately, he kind of does when he's in that pose.
Yeah, you really, you almost kind of feel sorry for Contador in a lot of ways, but to put the brave fight out for the Giro Tour job. I went to his press conference pre-tour. I'm like, I came out of there believing, man. It's like, Alberto's going to do it. And then once we got in the Pyrenees, we just saw he got shelled by the sky, gauntlet. And I think, I seriously don't even see him challenging for the podium at this point, in top five. And even today's little tepid attack over the top of the Mont, you know, he just doesn't have that power to stay and hold that gap to guys like Froome.
I think even Oleg Tinkoff was going better than him today, wasn't he, out on the road?
He was, and I don't know if Oleg, if riding alongside our car somehow rubbed off on Oleg, because I think Richard Moore, our esteemed colleague Richard Moore, put a tweet up earlier that Peter Sagan was the best rider in the Tour de France, and Oleg Tinkoff said exactly the same thing on France television after the stage.
Well, let's get to Peter Sagan, because that was the third day in a row that he's been in a break. He now has what looks an unassailable lead in the green jersey. He's been hoovering up points, second again on the stage, which takes his number of second places in Tour de France stage wins to about 106, I think, at this count. But we were talking in the car as we were driving, and we heard the news that he'd got in the break, and we were talking about the fact that really, when you compare riders, and it's a bit like comparing all of the categories in boxing, isn't it? You know, you can have the best pound for pound fighter, but might be a welterweight or a flyweight or a heavyweight. Peter Sagan is probably pound for pound the best bike rider in the world, as Richard and Oleg say, because he's very good at everything except actually getting over the line almost first at the moment.
And almost at, you know, the different skills in cycling are so different, the different disciplines and the physiology that it requires to do all those things. It's almost a hybrid of different sportsmen. It's almost, you know, we used the football analogy earlier, but a lot of our American listeners, Hoodie's here. I know Hoodie's got a big following in America, so they'll have all tuned in tonight. He almost reminds me of Bo Jackson. Remember Bo Jackson? Baseball, American football. Was there another sport they played?
Track
and field.
Yeah,
he's like Superman. He's like a cartoon character.
Yeah, Super Sagan. I mean, I liked his finish line, pounding the chest. And they asked him, what was that from? And he said that Matthew McConaughey character in The Wolf of Wall Street. And then the Chinese TV asked Sagan, you know, why could you get down that mountain so fast? And his answer was, because I have really big balls.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned TV crew, the Chinese TV crew, because today I grabbed a word with the Slovak TV crew. There are a couple of them here. Cycling has exploded in Slovakia with the advent of Sagan and his success. This year, for the first time, the Slovak National Championship was televised live on national television. You know how many riders were in the Slovak National Championship? 4. And it was televised live on TV. But they were also riding on the same course in the same peloton as the Czech National Championship entrance. Anyway, Peter Stepanek, he is here for Slovak state television with one job and one job only. That is to follow Peter Sagan wherever he goes. Here he is, Peter Sagan. He doesn't make it easy for you, does he?
Of course, because when he's not on the podium, we have a very hard job to get a few words from him, because when he's not on podium, he's going to take a shower in the bus, and then the bus is leaving without any word. So we must check the director of the press of Tinkoff Saxo to get any information about Peter Sagan. But when he's in the mix zone, there is no problem with him.
I understand that, you know, you've had to sprint after him a lot of days, and he doesn't always give the most elaborate answers, does he?
Yeah, he's extrovert. You cannot imagine in which kind of mood he is, but he does very well communicate with the press. When he gets a stupid question, he gets a stupid answer. So you must be aware. What do you think
to ask him, because it's very hard to be focused on his mood. When he is in a not good mood after the second places, you must start the questions like, it was a perfect stage for you, but just the second place, but you have some kind of points for the green jersey, so you must be satisfied. Afterwards, he's going to smile a little bit because of the green jersey, but he is very, very angry about the second places.
Have you made any mistakes with your questions and annoyed him at any point in this Tour de France?
This Tour de France, not, but last year he wasn't able to answer questions in the mix zone because he was too angry. He made just an international signal for the Italian TV, and afterwards he was very busy, and we came a day after to his bus to Cannondale, and I was asking him about the second place because he lost just by 1 millimeter or so on, and he was just answering, what is this for a stupid question? I'm focusing on the next stage. I don't want to answer this question. What is this for a stupid question? I had with this a lot of problems in the Slovak media, because the Boulevard media get this interview on the YouTube, and a lot of fans from Slovakia told that I'm the stupid one. And I'm the stupid commentator from Slovak television and the reporter, and I should ask normal questions. So it's very hard also to, because the Slovakian people love Peter Sagan, and I must be aware to ask him normal questions.
And he always tells us that it's impossible for him almost to go back to Slovakia and live in Slovakia now because there's so much attention. He gets stopped in the street all the time. Is that the reality?
Yeah, this is the reality. He's the most known sportsman of Slovakia. He's the ambassador of cycling for the whole nation. Until he was by Tour de France 4 years ago, the cycling wasn't so popular in Slovakia. But when he started to win the stages, when he started to be the one of the best cyclists in the world, superstar, the Slovakian people voted him for the best sportsman of the year. Afterwards, we have the best viewing rates ever for cycling. Every day we have 700,000 from 5 million Slovakian people. And on Saturdays and Sundays, even more. And for the Paris stage, we have like 1 million, and this 1 million we got just by the final of the World Championships by ice hockey, which is the most popular sport in Slovakia. When we won the World Championships 2002, we had 1.5 million. So Peter Sagan is very popular. He cannot live in Slovakia, because when he is coming to Slovakia, he cannot move from one street to another, because he must sign some stuff. So this is true. He is the most popular sportsman in Slovakia.
And now, Le Pédaleur de Charme, supported by British Eurosport.
Well, that brings us on very neatly to our daily Pédaleur de Charme competition, which is brought to you in association with British Eurosport, and it's for the most charming pedalling. And Peter Sagan was cruelly pipped yesterday, set into second place by, was it Michał Kwiatkowski yesterday, I think, wasn't it?
I don't know, we're very behind, aren't we, on awarding the jerseys?
Yeah, we are. We've got to dish out a lot of these T-shirts on the rest day. We've got about half a dozen riders to go and give T-shirts to. But today, there can be no doubt, if for nothing other than the descent of the Col de Monts, Peter Sagan wins the Pédaleur de Charme. I mean, it was an extraordinary descent. Lots of people, when you talk to riders, because I did a piece about descending earlier this week, lots of riders always say, oh, Vincenzo Nibali, Peter Sagan, they're the best at going downhill. And Sagan pushed everything to the limit to try and close that gap to Ruben Plaza. He was jumping forward and sitting on the crossbar with his big balls, Andy. I mean,
I think that the really incredible thing about Sagan's descending is his ability to remedy mistakes. Mm. He's such a phenomenal bike handler that he made 5 or 6 fairly significant mistakes on that descent, yet he was able to correct them, and in such a way that he gained 30 seconds or more, actually probably more like 40 seconds on the guys he'd gone over the top of the climb with. So just an incredible exhibition. I think probably he is a level ahead of Nibali.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal descent. I mean, it was a heart-in-mouth moment when his bike sort of flicked from under him, but he managed to correct it and then steer around the corner. You know, a bit like sort of a Shire horse trying to go round a tight corner, but he kept the bike upright, he kept his speed up, and there was not even a flicker. He was straight back on the pedals. A real sort of masterclass of descending. Not quite enough to net him the stage, but he has won himself a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt, and I'm sure he will be absolutely ecstatic about that.
I'm sure it will make his tour and Tinkoff's tour. Hoodie, you've been very quiet on the old Pedaleur de Charme.
Well, after watching Sagan race this Tour de France, I will say right now, he's going to win the World Championships in my home country.
You heard it here first.
He never wins anything. He never wins anything.
He will win that one.
He only wins in your home country, in fact, doesn't
That's
he?
That's true. He won a Tour of California. I mean, come on. He likes America beef.
Fantastic. Can I tell the fantastic story about Peter Sagan's girlfriend at the Tour of California? I think it's probably safe for public consumption now. Apparently, there was an incident, I think, a day or two before the start of the Tour of California. Every team was warming up on the same bike path, I think. Was it Sacramento, Hoodie, where it started? Anyway, there was a team time trial, wasn't there, in the Tour of California? Was there a team time trial? I don't know anything about the Tour.
It was at the Giro this year, sorry.
Okay, well, anyway, all the teams were going out for their pre-Tour of California ride on this same bike path that was going up the coast somewhere in California. But Peter Sagan's girlfriend also joined Tinkoff Saxo team that day, and they were all riding pretty much in single file. I think she came out of the line on a bit of a chicane. The giant Alpecin team were riding towards them en masse in single file, and she took out the whole team, I'm led to believe.
Well, just lastly then, before we wrap up, because we need to go and pick up Richard from the Col de Monts. Hopefully he's sitting in the shade somewhere enjoying a cold drink, but we don't want to leave him sat up there too much longer into the evening. Andy, what are the highlights you're looking forward to in of the four Alpine stages? Which one really stands out for you the most?
Yeah, of course, the stage Alpe d'Huez. I mean, it's going to be an epic battle. I think Froome's going to win. He has this thing pretty much wrapped up under control. And I've just been impressed by how composed and articulate Froome's been in this whole onslaught about this power of numbers business and really, you know, attacks from all sides. He's had more attacks off the bike than he's had on the bike during this Tour de France, and I think he's handled himself really well. So I think for him, to see him win at the top of the Alpe d'Huez in yellow jersey, I think it's a worthy victory for how he's raced this Tour.
And in terms of the reporting of the race, I mean, do you get excited about these watts per kilo numbers, the estimates, the guesstimates?
Oh, sure. I think that's kind of the secret code of modern cycling. And before, I think it was, which doctor you had. Yeah, I think these numbers, these threshold numbers and these power numbers, that is the way these guys race. That is the way to understand the sport at this elite level. I think it's very good that this Grappe is going to be doing some stuff for the journalists. I know Sky's brought in some journalists to explain kind of what they're doing, some off-the-record chats. I think a lot of people just make assumptions. I think a lot of people read things and just believe them without really understanding what the discussion's all about. And I think, I think Froome, you know, you change a few numbers in his formulas and his numbers suddenly, or pas normal, they're right back in the normal range. And, you know, who knows, maybe Chris Froome is a clean rider and everyone's missing that story. And what a big story that would be that like you said, it's not the Wild West anymore.
I think the problem is that the scientific, we refer to the scientific community or the physiologists en masse as though is it some kind of homogenous group when it's not. There are huge divisions within that group. And, you know, I mentioned Fred Grapp of the FDJ earlier, and he said to me that the program last night on Chris Froome's wattage on the Pierre Saint-Martin, he thought that it was about 20 watts out for Froome, and he said the difference between Quintana and Froome on that Pierre Saint-Martin climb was 1 minute in time, which equates to about 12, 13 watts. So their, what he thought was their margin of error was actually more than Chris Froome is beat Nairo Quintana by that day. So, you know, the huge differences of opinion even between those physiologists, those, you know, very well-respected scientists in a lot of cases.
Well, Chris Froome in the press conference today did confirm that his weight is currently 67 or 68 kilos. So that gives you one variable of a kilo's difference. But listeners to our special Chris Froome, Dave Brailsford interview, which we put out for friends of the podcast in the first week, would have heard that already. They would already have known that Chris, his racing weight is 67 kilos.
What's your racing weight at the moment, Lionel? You How's it evolved in this tour? Because I know we've talked a lot about my heat stroke, but I can recommend heat stroke as a device for losing weight, because I reckon I've shed at least 2 or 3 kilos in the last couple of days.
Well, perhaps I ought to stand in the sun French Foreign Legion style tomorrow and give myself about a heat stroke. We better not detain Andy Hood too much more or use him up too much, because he's coming back tomorrow for our Velo News edition of the Cycling Podcast together with Kaylee Fretz. There'll be an American slant to that episode that will go out on the rest day. Just a plug for a couple of things that we've done. American flavour to our Kilometre Zero today. Daniel's put together the Lance Armstrong episode of Kilometre Zero. It's divided the internet in half. Well, perhaps not even half, but in two. One very small segment who think it was a great episode, and then 98% of people who think we were completely out of order for even discussing Lance Armstrong. Those figures may not be verified, but something in that ballpark. And coming up later this week, it's Monday already, isn't it? Coming up later this week, we will finally be releasing for friends of the podcast The Perk, which is the podcast's response to Cycling's Independent Reform Commission report, which was published in March. We've gathered interviews and we've chewed over all the various different angles of the doping / anti-doping debate, and we're finally ready to release it to the world, aren't we, Daniel?
We are. Interviews from, can we name some of the interviewees? Antoine Vaya, Brian Cookson, Jörg Jaksha, who else?
Paul Voss, who's riding the Tour de France. One other rider we're hoping to get tomorrow.
Hayo Seppel, the ARD reporter, a specialist on doping matters.
Jonathan Vorters.
And others.
And ourselves, Richard Moore, Daniel Frieben, myself. Well, let's wrap it up there and go and pick up Richard from the mountain. Andy, we will hear from you in the Velo News edition of the Cycling Podcast. Thank you very much.
Good night, fellas. Thanks.
And Daniel Freed, thank you.
Thank you.
During the Tour de France, listen twice a day to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. There is all the latest interviews and analysis from every stage in the evening show. And in the morning, Monday to Friday, Kilometer Zero will take you inside the tour in the company of the podcast team, Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.